So, just trying to be a little bit more efficient with the time. That's the point of the handout. So, there's this big picture I have in my mind. The idea, informally, is the real line has no holes. I've said that before. And four precise versions of that statement are given on one of the pages. Right? Four kinds of completeness of the real line. And we start by assuming one of them, the completeness property. And then on day nine, I went through a proof of the nested intervals theorem assuming the completeness property. Spent longer on that than I expected. Then I had to rush and try and do the next one, which is where we go from nested intervals to Bolzano-Weierstrass theorem, another completeness property. The picture for that argument, again, is just repeated bisection. Right? So you have a bounded sequence, so what does it do? You know, it visits points on an interval. Now, it might visit the same point many times, right? There's no rule that says a sequence can't repeat. And the question was, what I want to get out of this is a convergent subsequence, or equivalently, a cluster point. And so the idea is, the sequence goes on forever. It may repeat itself, but there's always another natural number which we can plug into the sequence. So you have your interval, and you cut the interval in half, and you say the sequence is bounded by this interval by assumption, and it's going to visit one half or the other infinitely often. Or it could visit both infinitely often, right? But if it's stuck in this interval for all time, right? It's a bounded sequence. If it's stuck in there forever, it's visiting that interval infinitely often. And so then it's just a question of, does it visit the bottom half infinitely often, or does it eventually stop visiting the bottom half, right? After 700 terms, do I never see anything in the bottom half? Maybe. What about the top half? Same question. There's three possible answers, right? It eventually stops visiting the bottom half. It eventually stops visiting the top half. Or it visits both halves infinitely often. You can't say it eventually stops visiting both halves because it's got to be somewhere in there. So one half or the other, or both, is visited infinitely often. Let's say the top half is visited infinitely often. Right? I don't care if they're both visited infinitely often, just as long as one of them is visited infinitely often. And then we just look in here, and we look within here, and we say, okay, now we know the sequence comes here infinitely many times, right? Well, again, you can do the same argument. Either infinitely many of those times are in the top half of this one, or they're in the bottom half. Or both. But you can't say it eventually stops visiting the bottom half and it eventually stops visiting the top half because it would eventually stop visiting the whole thing then. So, and by assumption, we pick the half that it never stops visiting. It may take breaks and visit this one, but it always eventually comes back again. So again, we can just pick a half. Let's say the bottom half of this one gets visited really often. And we just keep doing this. As long as we pick a half that's visited infinitely often, then we just shrink down. And we're shrinking down exponentially fast. And so you get these narrow, narrow intervals. And so in there is your cluster point. There may be other cluster points, but we found one, right? And how do we know it's a cluster point? Because if you wait long enough, right, shrink enough, and eventually you'll have an interval so short that whatever epsilon you're caring about, you'll find that your interval is less than epsilon long, and whoa, wait a minute. Okay, so now I've got my cluster point in here.
And there's an interval of width less than epsilon, and this interval is visited infinitely often.
So if your sequence is called, you know, an or whatever, right? All you have to do is pick one of these intervals smaller than your epsilon. And by the nested intervals theorem, there's a point inside all of these nested intervals. And by the fact that you're always cutting the length in half, you know that eventually you'll be small enough to be less than epsilon, right? 1/2 to the power n goes to 0 in the limit. So, no problem. Right? Just wait until you've cut down to an interval of length less than epsilon, and that's in there. That's the informal version, right? I'll try to be a little more careful on the board. It's also, you can read the version of the book. Now, the new thing today is the idea of another version of no holes in the real line. So, Bolzano-Weierstrass theorem, right? Every bounded sequence has a cluster point. We have what you might call Cauchy completeness. This will prove today. Now, you can complete the circle. Okay, so these four different completeness properties I put in the handout. Completeness property, which is about bounded monotone sequences. Right? There's a bound, maybe it's increasing up to the bound. It doesn't have to, you know, get close to the bound, but the point is it's bounded. That forces it to stabilize somewhere because it's increasing, so it can't oscillate, and it can't just zoom off to infinity because it's got the bound. That was the first kind. Second kind was nested intervals theorem. Third kind, Bolzano-Weierstrass. Fourth kind, Cauchy completeness. It says that every Cauchy sequence converges. That's the fourth concept on the list, too. Now, we'll prove that today. And as part of your homework, I want you to complete the circle. To show that all four of these completeness concepts are really the same in a logical sense, we show that first one implies second one implies third one implies fourth one, right? So this is the third one implies fourth one that we'll do today. And then as part of your homework, you go and show that the fourth one implies the first one. So it's a logical circle of implications. They all imply each other. So logically, they're all equivalent. You could think of it as the kinds of real number concepts that satisfy one of these four kinds of completeness that are the same as the kinds of real number concepts that satisfy the other kinds of completeness. They're all saying the same thing, right? Just in different ways. And I think of it as them all saying the real line doesn't have a hole. So that's... And you can't cheat, right? If you want to prove that Cauchy completeness implies the original completeness property about monotone bounded sequences, then it would be cheating to assume the completeness property, right? That would defeat the purpose of showing that these are really the same idea. Right? So you don't want to assume what you're trying to prove. You assume the Cauchy completeness, and then from that, you get to the original completeness property. Just working with a definition. And the strategy I give for this, I give a hint in the homework, and I also mention my little summary in one of the other pages, where I say all four kinds are equivalent. And you can use this exact same kind of argument here to prove it. Okay? Except now, this time,
when you cut up based on which interval is visited infinitely often, you need to argue, using the fact that you are working with a monotone sequence, that you get something better than just a cluster point. You have to use the fact that your sequence is also monotone to prove that you're actually going to get a limit, not just a cluster point. So it's basically this argument, but you need to use the fact that you're talking about monotone sequences in the completeness property to improve the conclusion from cluster point to limit. Questions or comments? So, here we go. What is Cauchy? Well, Cauchy was a man. What is a Cauchy sequence? Why do we name it after him? He thought up it first. So I put the definition here on the page of the handout. What it means is the sequence eventually stabilizes. So we get a little comparison here. If I give you a real number L in a sequence and I say A sub N converges to L, that means for each positive epsilon, what do you have? You have that the sequence stabilizes around L. So you have this picture of L, and then L plus epsilon, L minus epsilon, and there's some kind of wait time, right? But once you've waited long enough, everything in the sequence is less than epsilon away from L. There can be other stuff where who knows what happens before the wait time, but there's only a finite amount of stuff before the wait time. If the sequence starts at n equals 0, whatever, and then there's finite many terms that may be horrible, then everything is nice in the sense of being close to L. The Cauchy sequence concept doesn't say anything about a limit number. So it's a different picture. So it says that the sequence eventually stabilizes, but it doesn't say that it stabilizes around any particular number. It just says that, all the terms get close together. So after the first 700 terms or whatever, if you look at any two terms in the sequence beyond that, they're not that far apart. Maybe they're 0.01 or less apart, something like that. I guess in our formal definition, we use the epsilon close, right? So we say they're strictly less than some number epsilon. For each epsilon, there's supposed to be a wait time. Once you wait long enough, everything past that wait time, you look at any two terms in the sequence, they're close together. So now we have this picture here. And so now there's no L and L plus epsilon, L minus epsilon to think of as kind of an absolute thing to compare to. Now we're just saying that if you have your wait time, N. So you look at some term out here in the sequence. Maybe I look at this one. So this is my A sub N. I look at another one later. It's my A sub m. We're saying that if you measure the distance between these two, it should be less than epsilon.
Milovich.
Yeah.
What did you write on the far right?
You're just right again over here. That's a bad spot on the board.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right, so. Okay. So kind of, in the time coordinate, with the ends, the M, right? We have one thing. And in the vertical coordinate, we have two terms in the sequence, right? Let's say we're looking at, this is N, this is M. And so we're grabbing, this one. Look at any two late times, so any two times at least this wait time n at epsilon, and then look at the corresponding terms of the sequence, and they're supposed to be less than epsilon away from each other. So we're not telling you what the sequence stabilizes around, but we're telling you it's stable in some sense. Wait long enough, everything is close to everything else. You just have to throw away a finite number of early outliers, right? For the first 1,000 terms of the sequence, there may be stuff that's very far apart from other stuff. But after 1,000 terms, then everything is, you know, less than 0.1 away from everything else. All sorts of bad stuff, you know, of course, may happen, you know, earlier, whatever. But after the wait time, everything looks approximately the same. So this is a way of capturing the real line having no holes in some sense, because you want to say that, that the sequence should be stabilizing around something, right? You know, eventually it gets 1 over 10 stable, right? Everything is less than a tenth from everything else, so the first decimal point, the first digit after the decimal point should be about the same, right? There might be a little oscillation between like 0.19 and 0.20, but except for that kind of issue, you've got the first digit nailed down. Then you wait longer, and you've got everything is less than 1/100th away from everything else. So now you're looking at the next decimal place, and you're saying, well, okay, maybe there's a little switch off between 1.79 and, you know, 1.80 or something like that. But aside from that kind of issue, we've nailed down the second digit, and we just keep going. You know, wait until when epsilon is 1 over 1,000, then after that wait time, the third digit should be pretty much stabilized. Again, except for the kind of 999 versus 000 issues. So we want to say that this should be stabilizing towards something. Okay. And that's Cauchy completeness. That's, that's what I call, I guess, completeness property D on the handout. Every Cauchy sequence converges. So there should be some number L in here that the sequence really is stabilizing around. If there isn't, then there's a sense in which the real line has a hole, and we need to rethink whatever real number concept we picked and pick a better one. The decimal sequence concept doesn't have any holes, for roughly the reasons I just said. Okay, so a little basic thing you can do just to test your familiarity with these definitions, kind of a warm-up. Okay, so we think that a Cauchy sequence should converge. We'll do something backwards here. Can you prove something easier? Can you prove that a convergent sequence is Cauchy? Right?
other words,
if a sequence is eventually stabilizing around a number L, then all the terms in the sequence should be close to each other, right?
How do we prove this? It's basically the triangle inequality.
The idea is if you wait long enough, and I have two terms in the sequence, and I assume they're convergent, well, they're both close to this number L. Well, if they're both close to L, they must be close to each other, right? That's all that's going on. Okay.
So, let's see. Here's an explicit version, okay? So let's assume it converges. Okay. Then we have a wait time, right? That witnesses that.
If you have a positive epsilon and you have a natural number n, at least the wait time, then that implies that the corresponding term in the sequence is less than epsilon away from L. Okay?
So now you want to have two terms be less than epsilon away from each other. You have a slight problem here in the sense that you might have something down here near L minus epsilon and something up here near L plus epsilon. So now they're almost 2 epsilon apart.
Okay, no problem. Just wait until they're epsilon over 2 close, right?
So let's say we have M greater than, how do I usually write it? I'll write it from left to right, smaller in the experience. So let's say I wait until everything is epsilon over 2 close to L. Then the problem is solved. So now I have a sub n is less than epsilon over 2 away from L, which in turn is epsilon over 2 away from a sub m, right? Because these are both after the epsilon over 2 wait time, so they're both epsilon over 2 close to L. And the trick is here, I can plug in any number I want, as long as it's a positive real number, into the wait time function. So, I guess, what am I missing here? I guess I should say this works for any epsilon, right? This trick works for any positive epsilon. You divide it by 2, plug it into the wait time function. And now it's just the triangle inequality. If your, epsilon is 0.1, then this is 0.05 when you divide by 2. So if it's at most 0.05 from here to here, and then at most 0.05 from here to here, actually we're getting strictly less than, then it's strictly less than 2.05s, or 0.1, from the AN to the AM.
Epsilon close to everything else, wait for everything to be epsilon over 2 close to this limit L. Because then you've got this band right here. This band is 2 epsilon wide, right? Epsilon over, epsilon to epsilon under. We just need to shrink the band down by a factor of 2. So we may have to wait longer, but eventually it'll happen because you can pick the epsilon to be as small as you want. Thank you. questions about that argument or the Cauchy concept? Next step is to do this proof, to go from this theorem, Lozano-Weierstrass, that says every bounded sequence has a convergent subsequence, or equivalently, it has a cluster point. And from that, we need to deduce that every Cauchy sequence converges. And I put a little outline of that in the handout. There's three steps to it. First, you prove a Cauchy sequence is bounded. No matter what the Cauchy sequence is, if you know it's Cauchy, you know it's bounded. Second, you assume the Lozano-Weierstrass theorem, and that tells you, oh, hey, I've got this Cauchy sequence that I just proved is bounded, so it has a cluster point. That's the second step, actually using this hypothesis. Then the third step is you say, okay, so with a general sequence, it could oscillate forever between, say, negative 1 and positive 1. So it could have two cluster points, right? But neither one is an actual limit of the sequence because it never stabilizes around one of them. But in a Cauchy sequence, we are stabilizing, right? Everything is eventually close to everything else. So you can't have multiple cluster points. You can't have a cluster point and then a subsequence going off to infinity or any nonsense like that. If it has a cluster point, that cluster point actually has to be the limit if we're talking about a Cauchy sequence. So those are the three steps. And again, I outlined them in the handout. Let's implement them. Step one, if An is Cauchy, then it is bounded. I think I put a circle around the one in the handout, so I'll put a circle around there. Yeah, that's on the all four kinds are equivalent page. And from C to D, we have the three steps. So let's see, a little proof of this. So eventually, everything is not too far apart. So it seems like it should be bounded, right? It should fit inside some little band of numbers, since nothing can get too far away from anything else. And then you have to worry about the finally many exceptions. No problem. Okay, so we already proved in an earlier class day that if you have a sequence that's eventually bounded, then it's bounded. Because if there's finitely many terms that don't fit in your eventual bounds, you just pick the greatest of those terms that's not in the bounds to be your better upper bound, right? And if there's terms that get too low, but only finitely many of them, just pick the least of those, right? We went through that argument already. So if the sequence is bounded eventually, then it's just bounded. Because again, there's only finitely many numbers before the eventually becomes true. So you can just use the greatest and least of those numbers to expand your bounds if necessary. Easy picture, right? Sequence is eventually bounded after the wait time. Early stuff may not follow the bounds, but if necessary, you can expand the bounds.
because there's only finitely many early things, right?
So I won't repeat it. That was several class days ago. That was maybe first week, or second week when we introduced. It was when we introduced the for n sufficiently large concept. Okay. So given a n Cauchy, we just need to prove that it's eventually bounded. Now we use the definition of Cauchy. Right? So we have a wait time. Right? Okay. So you can either write it out explicitly. You say, let there be some function n of epsilon such that blah, blah, blah. Or you can just say, in shorter version, since the sequence is eventually getting epsilon stable, for every epsilon, how about we just pick an epsilon? How about epsilon equals 1? Long enough, everything in the sequence is less than distance 1 away from everything else. I don't need the whole wait time function for this argument. I just need its value for distance 1. So whatever that wait time is, wait that long. Everything will be not too far apart. Okay? Well, now let me just pick a term here, okay? How about I choose? Make up a number. Let's call it K, okay? I want it to be a natural number, right? So just pick one of the terms in the sequence now, basically, where I've waited long enough for things to get at least mildly stable. Okay. So I'm picking a term that's this an a sub k, right, where it came late enough that everything is close to everything else. So for all n, at least that wait time capital N, what do we have? We have a sub k is less than 1 away from a sub n, right? Because everything is less than 1 away from everything else after that wait time. In particular, just pick one of the terms, I don't care which. You could pick the first one that there is. Maybe it's capital N itself, if capital N is an integer. Just pick one, and everything has to be close to that one because we've waited for things to stabilize. Well, what does this mean? This less than one away thing, it just means that if you look at any term here in the sequence, it's between a sub k minus 1 and a sub k plus 1. Okay? That's all it means. A lot of times, all you have to do is unpack the definition, remember what it meant, and it solves the problem of where to go next. Right? It tells you what you need to prove, and it
often it gives you what you need to prove. Look, here are the bounds we need. Everything will eventually be in this band between a sub k minus 1 and a sub k plus 1, because everything is close to a sub k, because late in the sequence, everything is close to everything else.
Maybe I should use double circles or something, because I'm using a single circle there.
I'm not even sure I strictly need to write number 6 here. I mean, but to make it extra clear, we're proving what we needed to prove. All right. Okay. We proved it's eventually bounded, and that's enough, because after dealing with the Feynman early exceptions, you can get an actual bound. So that's the step one, going from bounded sequences have convergent subsequences to Cauchy sequences converge. I have to show that Cauchy sequences are actually bounded. Okay. Any questions about this proof? So step two is in the handout, and it doesn't need any proof, right? It's just direct, right? Assume Bosanov-Weierstrass, and since you've got a Cauchy sequence, and you now know it's bounded, the Weierstrass has bounded sequences has cluster points. All four kinds are equivalent. C to D, step two. Each Cauchy sequence has a cluster. Cauchy property to bump things up from mere cluster point, something that we get close to infinitely often, to limit, something that we're eventually always close to. As I said before, we're not allowed to oscillate between two cluster points, or oscillate between one cluster point and tending to infinity. And that's exactly what the Cauchy stability gives us. Ends are a sequence that's Cauchy and clusters at C, then actually it converges. And I guess I shouldn't write too far over, right? We have a wait time function that witnesses Cauchy. I'll go ahead and write that out. Let a sub n be epsilon close to a sub m for all positive epsilon and all m greater than n greater than or equal to this wait time capital N of epsilon.
So we're just saying everything's eventually close to everything else. Let's just unpack the definition of Cauchy. And then two, we have a cluster point. So let let A sub n get epsilon close to C infinitely off. That's what I write IO for abbreviation. And this happens for each epsilon. That's the definition of cluster point. For any epsilon, no matter how small, you will get epsilon close to this thing infinitely often. You may oscillate and get far away from it some of the time, but you're going to come back and get close to it infinitely many times. Okay. Now, to really use this, we need to, I think, say more explicitly what infinitely often means for us. It means means that for each number of, call it R, right, there is a K, at least R. I need more. I need for each R and each epsilon. So for each positive epsilon and for each, think of this as a wait time, if you like. After waiting a long time, if you wait longer, you'll visit C again. You'll get close to it again. Exactly. Term after term R will be epsilon close, but there's going to be one term after term R that is epsilon close. And then, of course, after that term, there will also be another term. Epsilon over 2 trick again. Okay? So wait until everything is epsilon over 2 close to everything else, right? Okay. And then if you look at two terms in the sequence, They're less than epsilon over 2 apart now. Okay, great. But I don't want to just look at any two terms in the sequence. Okay. Let's say this is A sub n.
let's say this is, let me look at, I really want to mess with this. Let me look at a term right here that's also close to C. Okay. Maybe C is down here. So what I do is I choose M to be one of those terms that where we get close to C. How close? Epsilon or too close? See in the picture, we're not assuming what we're proving, right? We're not assuming that every term is epsilon close to C. But we do know that infinitely often there will be terms close to C. And we know that if we wait long enough, all terms are close to each other. So we wait for everything to be close together, and then if whatever term you care about picks some later term that's also close to C, because we know there's always going to be more and more of those terms because we get close to C infinitely often. And so now you're from an arbitrary late term to one of those infinitely many terms close to C. We put the two closenesses together to say we have two late terms close to each other, and one of those is close to C. Well, these are both close to C. So, okay, so given opposite epsilon, here's the formal version of my picture here, right? If n is at least the wait time for epsilon over 2, then A sub n is epsilon close to C, which is exactly what you need in order to prove a limit statement, right? Eventually, every term is epsilon close to your target. Let's get C. Because A sub n is epsilon over 2 close to A sub m, which is epsilon over 2 close to C, where n is some point that is just one of those infinite terms that puts you close to C. So we know that we have any point late in the sequence, then we pick a later point, like this M, right? No, that's bigger than N, right? So that's how we define this visiting function V, right? You give it a distance demand and then a wait time. It says, okay, after that, we're going to get epsilon close to C again. In this case, we plugged in epsilon over 2 and N. So we're saying, after term N, we're going to get epsilon over close to C again. Or maybe for the first time, I don't know. But either way, we're going to get... There's going to be a term that gets epsilon over 2 close to C in the future. So you put the two epsilon over 2 closenesses together, and you've got your epsilon closeness.
So this,
I made this, you know, somewhat a more explicit proof. I put in actual functions to represent all the things that are asserted to happen, whether they happen eventually all the time or they just happen incrementally often. You don't necessarily have to write the proof of all those explicit functions. You can say stuff like, for some, you know, number sufficiently large, you're talking about for infinitely often. And when you're talking about eventually always, you say, for all n sufficiently large.
Questions about this proof?
This is an attempt to formalize an intuitive statement of Cauchy completeness. Cauchy implies bounded because stability implies eventually bounded. Because there are no holes in the real line, boundedness gives us a cluster point. So part of the sequence is clustering around it, right? Part of the sequence actually converges to it. But since we have a Cauchy sequence where eventually everything is close together, it must be that actually the whole sequence commits to this point as an actual limit, not just a cluster line. But I repeat myself. So it's easy to say some kind of informal argument like that. It takes me a lot longer to write out something a little more formal. Now, what I'd like to do is now talk about how do you actually prove that a random sequence is Cauchy. Sometimes you'd like to prove a sequence converges, and so now we have another tool for that. Prove it's Cauchy. Our previous tool for proving a sequence converges without knowing a limit was what? We proved it was bounded and monotone. Right? Like a bounded above and increasing, right? Or bounded below and decreasing. That was a way to prove a limit existed without knowing what the limit was. Now we have another big tool that will work for sequences that oscillate, as long as the oscillations can get smaller and smaller, so it's stabilizing. So the trick will be, how do you prove something is Cauchy? And that will tie into the next chapter, chapter 7. How do you prove that series converge when you don't know what they converge to? And so the idea is show that the difference between any two late terms is small. I have some examples for that. Not as much time as I'd like for all my examples, but I can write down some examples on paper and put them on the website if time does not permit me to go through all of them here. I made this list of 7 examples, right? I'm not going to get through them all now. So I can write the others up so you can see the tricks I use. There's basically 2 ideas, okay? So now, okay. So you want to prove that that if you have late terms in the sequence, they're not changing very much, right? But given some epsilon, you want to show that they're close together eventually. Okay? And one way to do it is we'll say this is strategy one. And here's what you do. You think of this change, right? Maybe a sub n is the millionth term, but a sub m could be much, much later. It could be the billionth term. So how do you compare the change between these two late terms in the sequence when they could still happen at times very far apart? Well, one attack is to break it up. Okay? Use the triangle inequality here in the general form. So what do we say? Write it out as this term minus the previous term plus that term minus the previous term. So you break it up into successive differences. Okay? So you get all the way down to the earliest term here, the second earliest term minus the earliest term. Okay. So you think of the difference from late term to very late term as adding up the differences between all the consecutive terms along the way. And now you can use the triangle inequality. I mean, in general, some of these differences could be positive, some could be negative. They could all cancel out. Or they might not. So how do we do a proof if we don't know? We assume the worst case, right? And we just try, and hopefully the worst case will still be something where we can prove it's small. But if we don't know in detail how all the cancellation is going to work out, okay, let's just round up to the uncanceling worst case, where all these differences are positive or all negative. So there's no cancellation to help us, right? So you're just comparing all these consecutive terms. I think I'd like to write it, I also like to write it going the other way, because this is, I think of n here is future, and then m is even more distant future. So if I want to write it kind of from left to right as time progresses, then I'd like to order it this way. So I find this slightly more natural to think about. So you're just comparing all the differences. And how do we know that these many, many differences will add up to something small? Unfortunately, it's not enough even to prove that consecutive terms have small differences. You have to prove that many consecutive differences add up to something small, not just that, oh, from one term to the next, it's a small change. You have to prove that from one term to many terms later, it's still a small change. How do you know many small changes don't add up to a big change? You compare it to a case where they do. Now, there is a case we've looked at where many small things still add up to a small thing, and that's the geometric series. So it is, you try to find an r smaller than 1, but not negative, such that these terms are all shrinking by factor r. Okay.
If they're shrinking faster than factor R, great. But all you need is to prove that they're shrinking at least as fast as factor R. And maybe there's a few outliers, but if you can prove that at least eventually, after a finite number of exceptions, every difference is R times smaller, or even smaller than that, than the previous difference, then you've got a geometric series. Right? If you succeed, then you look at one of these things, and you have the first term, and then you can round up all these other terms to powers of R times the first one. Right? I guess call this equation, I don't know, three lines here. So I'm going to get down to the third one, right? And then this inequality here can be 4. Then you put those two together, and you have the next difference after this will be at most R times the first difference. And the next difference after that will be at most R times that. So at most R squared. So you get a 1 plus R squared plus da 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 da. To how far out are we going? To, I guess, M. I mean, you have to count the terms here. It's kind of a pain. Let's see. There's M minus n plus 1 terms here. So by the time you go all the way from n plus 1 to m, how many factors of R do you have? You have m minus n plus 1, I think. And then that in turn rounds up. Using the nice formula for the geometric series to what? I'll just round it up to that's R. Now, that doesn't look so great, right? Okay, I've got 1 minus R, but I need something small. I need to know that this is small. Okay. So you wait for this inequality to hold.
Let's say your wait time is capital N.
And then you can use, I guess we'll call this 5 here. Lines 5 and 6.
So now we have A. Here's a version of this. So we wait long enough. Let's say we pick a natural number there, okay? So capital N. If it's not natural, round it up to natural. Then I can do a similar version of this. And this time what I get is I start at... Uh,
I start not at these two late terms in the sequence, in looking at the differences, but I think about how those differences compare to very, very early on, the first place where I get this factor of R shrinking. And so I get something better. Okay? I get this. And so this is better because now we have a bunch of terms here. So you're going to have, to get from this capital N to this possibly later term N here, lowercase n, how far are you going to have to go? You're going to have to go lowercase n minus capital N times. Then you have some more powers of R. Okay, but again, eventually you get to over here, but now it's... moving M. And then, because the R is smaller than 1, right, you round it up. Right, but this time we have this nice factor in here. So now, so this is nicer. So I'm going to write it like this. So what I've done here is, once you prove that eventually you have exponential decay, you might say, right, that eventually things are shrinking by a factor of R, then from that point on, you have these differences, and by this rounding up to a geometric series, you see that there's only one term in here that still depends on time. Everything else just depends on the R and on the capital N now. The capital N is where we started getting exponential decay. There's only one term here. Just the one term right there. Okay. Now, since R is smaller than 1, R sub n goes to 0. Okay? And then the other stuff is just a constant multiple. So this whole difference will go to 0. All of this stuff. So that's the treasure.
That's you.
Starting to go into the edge of the board.
So you take all of these differences, you add them up, you round them up to a geometric series, and if you have way late terms in the sequence, then you can have that not only do later terms get really small, the pi power of r, but even the early terms, right, will be small. So you have a bunch of small terms, and the geometric sequence gives you gives you a bound. And so and then you have all constants, thanks to the geometric series, except for this one term, which goes to 0. Okay? So you round up these differences, and you go. Okay. So that's the trick, and I've run out of time. I won't force you to stay late. I will just
talk more about this on Wednesday. Get into some more of these examples and tell you about strategy two.